My name is Julio Montaner. I'm the director of the BC Center for Excellence in HIV/AIDS in British Columbia, Canada.
Viviano Perto. I work at the Brazilian Interdisciplinary AIDS Association.
I'm Paula Akizibwe from the AIDS and Rights Alliance for Southern Africa.
I'm Vuyiseka Dubula from Treatment Action Campaign in South Africa.
So my name is Dermot. I'm from the Stop AIDS Campaign in the UK.
My name is Dr. Francois Penta. I work for the Reproductive Health and HIV Research Unit at Fitz University.
I'm Peter Mgenyi, the director of Joint Clinical Research Center in Uganda.
Okay. My name is Nonkosi Khumalo. I'm the national chairperson of the Treatment Action Campaign in South Africa.
Hi, I'm Mark Harrington from the Treatment Action Group in New York City.
My name is Thomas Austin Obuluta. I work as a counseling and mental health supervisor.
My name's David Some, and I'm the medical focal point person assistant in the Kibera Project, MSF.
Now and in future, we are looking for safer, better medicines that are available and affordable to people that need it.
I wish we could have 0% HIV transmission to babies.
In the next 5 years, injecting drug users will be receiving hepatitis C treatment.
I'm worried about other issues which impact the access to medicines, and particularly two areas, free trade negotiations as well as the anti-counterfeiting agreement.
So ideally in the next 5 to 10 years, through the help of the government, through the help of the donors, they should be able to come together and provide drugs to all these kids.
For the next 5 years, I would like to see more medications with less side effects.
HIV, I would like to see people being put on more effective treatment and drugs that are fewer, such that it reduces the drug burden, or the pill burden for the patients. And again, I would like to see these people being followed more systematically to address issues of toxicity and to make the treatment more effective and better for each of the patients.
By expanding antiretroviral therapy coverage quickly and effectively, we have an opportunity to bring the curves down and ultimately control the epidemic. Not doing that today will cost us much more tomorrow.
Approaches that aim to deliver care within those realities, so taking care into the communities, not just relying on doctors to provide care, but using nurses, because we have many more of those, using community workers to do monitoring and adherence support.
I'm hoping that we'll have much better options and choices for treatment. And when I'm talking about better options, I'm talking even just on individual drugs, better, easier drugs to take.
To see that new drugs and come into the market, less toxic drugs also being developed, so that patients are able to take pills that are easy to swallow with less side effects, and also that in future they have future options in terms of their treatments in case they go into failure.
I think the first thing I'd like to see in the next 5 to 10 years is a health system that actually is patient friendly.
Then also patients feeling empowered that they do not have to necessarily rely on a facility to take care of themselves. Can they also be able to practice their own self-care strategies?
My dream for access to medicines in 10 years' time would be for need to link completely to supply and creation and innovation.
So we need to simplify the drugs that we have. One pill a day is my dream. I would like to take one pill and forget about my AIDS and just continue with my life every day.
In another 10 years, if we don't have drugs, the generation we will have HIV. And that will be the economy that will be there. There'll be sick people. There will not be well people. So for me, what I'd like to see is that people get access, so that the generation we leave behind will be an HIV-free generation.
And I'm particularly concerned about India to change and have TRIPS Plus agreements, which will actually hamper access to medicine by compelling them to agree to patent term extensions, which are like data exclusivity and what is called patent linkages. We're not going into the details of it. All of them actually delay the onset of generic competition, which makes medicines expensive.
Well, my dream for AIDS treatment is that, first and foremost, everybody in need of treatment accesses it.
That means running our clinics at times that are convenient to patients rather than what are convenient to healthcare workers, running systems that are cognizant of the fact that they have jobs and that they have families, that they have lives that they will need to go back to, that are not completely intertwined with the clinic.
What we'll wish for is drugs get to the guys in the community. We have clinics providing drugs, and guys have, the patients have to come all the way to get these drugs from the clinic.
Simplified ways of accessing treatment. Decentralize it. Decentralize it to the lowest level of the healthcare system. Get community healthcare workers, people like ourselves who have never been in a medical school but know enough about treatment.
With CD4, we need a dipstick that can tell you whether you have under 200 or under 350 CD4, so that we can decide whether you need to be started on prophylaxis for opportunistic infections or for ART. And then I think we need a viral load dipstick for early infant diagnosis and for just decisions on monitoring adherence and improving adherence counseling.
Let's do it. No, there's no time to wait.
Hi, is the microphone working? Okay. Good evening, everyone. Thanks ever so much for coming to attend this session. There's been a slight reordering of the speakers, but the content will remain the same. The purpose of the session is to look at some of the policy and operational game changers that we feel could have an impact on HIV management in the short and medium and long term. The session will be run in two parts. The first part will look at some of the potential game changers for bending the epidemiological curve in HIV and associated diseases. And the second part will look at efficiencies, ways of trying to bend the cost curve. So that the session will run in that way, in two separate parts. But before we get into that agenda, we have an opening address from Carl Diffenbach, who is director of the AIDS division at the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the NIH. Carl has had a distinguished career articulating urgent scientific questions and supporting key studies in a wide range of topics, including basic mechanisms of HIV disease, new approaches and tools on prevention and therapy, and long-term consequences of HIV disease management. So without further ado, I'd like to pass over to Carl for the opening address.
I really appreciate the invitation that MSF gave me to speak tonight, and I have a blank slate to start with, and I think that that's the best place to start, because I want to take you through the vision and in a visioning process, because where we are today and where we want to get to tomorrow does not have to necessarily grow in incremental ways. What we need to do is link what we're doing today with the innovations of research, think strategically about the research we wish to pursue with the long-term goal of ultimately eradicating HIV from the planet. We need to be able to think in those terms. If we don't think in those terms, as AIDS researchers, nobody else will for us. We need to own this. We need to drive forward on this. So let's take a moment and pat ourselves on the back for where we are today. We're treating over 5 million people. We have people in many, many countries around the world accessing therapy. That is a really good thing. However, the current model we have probably is not sustainable for much longer. We need to evolve. We need to continue to expand access, and we need a goal. We as civil society, we as researchers, we as healthcare providers need to endorse the goal of treating 15 million people by the year 2015. With that goal, with that kind of a goal, we need to then sit down and have a serious conversation about how do we get from where we are today to 2015. We need to be able to reduce the cost of delivering drugs, antivirals, to the individual patients. We need to be able to streamline and simplify the delivery of health care, at the same time making it affordable for the individuals in all parts of the world, as well as continue to stress the safety for the individual patient. Long term, we need to be able to do exactly what Mark said on the video. We need dipstick technologies. We need point-of-care diagnostics. All of these need to come together in evidence-based ways to get us to a point where we can continue to use the antivirals that we have today and that will be developed in the future. A major part of this will be trying to figure out how to dose reduce and simplify regimens, because that is another way that we can streamline and save antivirals. From the innovation side, from the research side, we need to be able to come up with a model where, starting at some point in the future, we can get to a point where we can test people, and once we're aware of their HIV infection, treat them with highly active antiretroviral therapy, and under the cover of heart, provide them with therapeutic vaccination that we know is effective, to a point where, after the vaccination strategy, they stop heart therapy, maintain low or no viral load, are not have such a low viral load that they are not able to transmit HIV to a partner, and then the funds that can be that were used to treat that person can then be used to treat another individual. So this concept of using drugs in a targeted, simplified way, getting to a point where you have the ability to give therapy in a very targeted way, and then essentially be able to monitor individuals as to whether or not the vaccine is rebounding is part of the vision. So where we want to get to is a point where HIV is eliminated from the globe. We need to also link in prevention activities throughout this, keeping in mind that there are multiple epidemics that we're dealing with simultaneously. Here in 2010 through 2015, the advantage of being able to scale up heart therapy is that it will have a profound impact on the TB epidemic as well. So as we move forward, we will have these ability to impact multiple epidemics. We will get to a point where we can have an impact on the health and well-being of HIV-infected people around the world. Long term, though, if we do not change what we're doing, we will be stuck in this rut of slowly increasing the number of people that are under treatment, and this will be a tragedy if we don't endorse this kind of a vision. So I'll stop here. I imagine some of you would like to challenge me on some of the things I've said, so let's open this up for questions. Mark.
On the cure, I think... This isn't on, I don't think. Is it on?
Yeah, there you go.
I just wanted to get your thinking a little bit more explicitly about the different kinds of cure research that we need to undertake over the next few years. That you sort of described the endpoint.
Yes.
But in the meantime, there's also going to need to be a look at strategies for actually sterilizing cure as well as functional cure. And I think it would be good to go into a little bit more detail just so people have an idea that there's quite a lot of different pathways into this.
Thank you for the question, Mark. You're absolutely right that there are essentially two ways of visualizing the cure, and I don't think they're mutually exclusive, and I actually think one leads to the other. You can conceive of a situation where there's immunity, boosted immunity within an individual that can lead to tight or precise virologic control of an HIV infection. That's similar to what we see in a group of patients called elite controllers. At the same time, there's the ability to directly eradicate the reservoirs or tackle the reservoirs in some way. These two fields overlap in terms of we need to understand the reservoirs, we need to be able to pursue both. And as the director of the Division of AIDS at NIAID, we will be pursuing both, because I think they both need to be tracked and followed. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Thanks very much. I believe that you're able to stay for much of the session, so if any questions come up, we might call on you later. Thanks very much, Carl. If I can call up the first panel, that's Mitt Phillips. I'll be handing over to Mitt Phillips, who is our health policy analysis and advisor with Médecins Sans Frontières in Belgium, and she'll be chairing this session, so I'll hand over to her. Thank you very much.
Okay, so let's kick off quickly. I must say also, I feel a bit schizophrenic because of all of some of the good perspectives that we have been hearing, both from the conference and also from the experience that we have on the field. And at the same time, there is also some fear. I think you have seen also the reports that MSF has brought out, the punishing success, the no time to quit, and you'll find in the back also the 10 consequences of AIDS treatment delayed, deferred, or denied. So I hope that in this session we can reduce a bit this schizophrenic, to bring the parts together. So I'm very happy also that we have two excellent speakers there. What we would like to come to is saying, well, where do we go from all the data that have been presented at the conference and that are an encouragement? Because Monday we'll have to go back into the real world and see how are we going to face this challenge and take the task up to realize promising perspectives. So in this session, we'll talk about the possibilities to bend the epidemic curves, and also about the policy constraints and opportunities that are in front of us. But as our first speaker, we have Dr. Ruben Greinich. He is the HIV-TB medical officer at the World Health Organization in Geneva, and he has a long experience in TB treatment scale-up and also in HIV. He is also the author of 2008 modeling study that was published in the Lancet and sparked off both excitement and controversy. It has fueled much of the debate at this conference also over the concept of antiretroviral therapy as prevention. We're very glad to have him here and with us to speak about on the potential of HIV treatment and heart in particular to bend the curves, the epidemiological curves in the coming years.
Thanks a lot for the invitation. Really appreciate it. I'm filling in for Dr. Gottfried Hernschau, who is our new director of the HIV/AIDS department at WHO, and I'll be delivering his talk. The other thing is, I was feeling a little bit chilled, so I asked him to turn up the heat a little bit. I hope that you guys are okay with that. I'm melting up here. So I'm going to talk about the new WHO recommendations for HIV treatment. This, and I'm going to go fairly quickly. This is a very savvy crowd. This is day four of a long conference. You know that we're up above 5.2 million people on ART. That's an incredible accomplishment. Most of you have been involved in that, and I think that's something to be very proud of. Of course, you know that there are many people that are waiting for treatment as well. We know that treatment, the benefits are clear. Won't go into the data specifically here, but basically people who are put on treatment actually survive and live much longer and healthier lives. This looks at some data that's coming out of Botswana that shows that you heard mentioned that ART has an effect on TB rates. We know that ART can reduce TB, which is the number one killer of people living with HIV, anywhere from 50% to 90%. And you see here that as ART coverage goes up, TB goes down. It makes sense. And we have a lot of data to support this. This slide actually talks a little bit about our guidelines process and developing policy. And WHO is a guidelines and normative agency, among other things. We consider the evidence. We come out with new guidelines, and this year we've come out with new ART guidelines, an update from the 2006 guidelines. How do we do that? Well, we have a new system at WHO. It's a guidelines review committee that looks after the committee that makes the guidelines. And if that sounds daunting, it is. It takes a long time, but we look at the randomized clinical control trials, the observational studies. We pull experts together. Many of you were a part of this process. And then we grade the evidence according to a formal process. We have methodologists that help us. We consider equity, risk, benefits, feasibility, acceptability, and these sorts of things. I'm not going to go through the studies, but these are some of the seminal studies that informed our thinking. and that we need this research in order to advance the guidelines. So thank you everybody who's supported this, and the patients and people that have made these possible. And we know that, and this informed our thinking about tuberculosis, and we know that ART early early ART help improve survival. Here's the, and I'm going fast, I'm really sorry, but most of you have probably seen these studies. This is Stern's paper in Lancet that talks about when to start, and we use this data. There weren't RCTs to help us, so we primarily relied on this data, among other things, to make a decision about the CD4 criteria. And the four guiding principles were to do no harm when we were doing our guidelines, ensure access and equity, promote quality and efficiency, and ensure a sustainability. So it's a complex calculus that goes into making these guidelines, but we think we got it right. The four key messages coming out of our new guidelines are start ART earlier, and I think the Lancet paper and other thinking on this helped move us in this direction, along with obviously the benefits for clinical morbidity and mortality and keeping people healthy and alive. Use less toxic, more patient-friendly options, and the regimens are now, we're moving away from D4T. Improve the management of TB, HIV, and HBV, HIV co-infections, and I think everybody should be aware that when you're diagnosed with TB and you have HIV, we recommend that you start ART immediately, and not later than 8 weeks. And so that's a new change, and that reflects the research that's come out recently. And then more strategic use of laboratory monitoring. So the goal, the benefits behind the new recommendations are reducing death, disability, and morbidity, costs for OI and cancer management, reducing orphanhood. These are all things that it's kind of like talking about apple pie and motherhood, but these are things that we think that the guidelines will help us with. And actually, let me go back to the last point, which is reducing HIV and TB. Actually, it should be HIV transmission and TB, or it could be HIV and TB transmission as well. But ART does reduce TB incidence and likely reduces transmission of TB. And then HIV, we're fairly certain now that that's the case, that when people are on ART, that there's a reduced transmission of HIV. Here's a table that looks at the different criteria and or the hazard ratios around the different the different CD4 bands, and it's coming from the Stern paper, and showing that as your CD4 count declines, you have a higher hazard ratio of death. And so the idea being is that we went with less than 350 as the optimum starting point. I just want to remind us, and you've probably seen this graph a few times at this conference and elsewhere, but this is looking at the community-based effects of, this is coming from Vancouver and Julio Montaner's work, looking at community viral load and HIV incidence, with the idea being that as you increase coverage and decrease community viral load, you decrease HIV incidence. We need far more research on this topic, but that's some evidence that ART is useful on a community-based level. There are other papers from Taiwan and some papers coming out of San Francisco as well. And this is the ATIA meta-analysis, and I hopefully you've all seen this as well, which pulls together discordant couple observational studies and suggests that really when you suppress viral load in discordant couples, there's very little or no chance of transmission. It's a very rare event. It can happen, and you would want to use other means of protection when you're on ART, but it really provides supportive evidence for the ART for prevention conclusion. So now the talk will switch gears a bit. We'll talk about some realities. First reality, you'll see that the tap is still open. You know that that there's probably around 2.7 million new infections a year. Last year, we put about 1.2 million people on ART. We're not keeping up. We need to do something different. The other thing is that mortality in sub-Saharan Africa is far higher than in Europe and North America, and that disparity needs to be addressed. And that has a lot to do with people starting far later on ART, and of course having access to ART. Here is something that we're very excited about. It's the idea is getting HIV testing out into the community, and I won't go into detail in all of this, but in the lower right you'll see a community-based campaign in Kenya which tested 40,000 people in 7 days. And then you see Obama getting tested there in Kenya as well. He's Kenyan after all, but he tested in Kenya on the left there, and then you see home-based testing and couples counseling. And I think we really need to, there's some challenges there, but we really need to think about how we can bring testing to far more people. a slide about drug pricing. I think we've made huge, and thanks to MSF and others, many of you work really, really hard, are still working on this, keeping prices low. I think you probably saw the paper that just came out in JAMA talking about how PEPFAR is using generic drugs and has saved hundreds of millions there. I think we need to continue that sort of work. That being said, pricing is, you know, it's getting pretty low there. I don't know how much lower we can go. And most of the cost is actually not drug-related costs. It's all the services that go around delivering the delivering ART. And that's where we actually can probably get more efficiencies and bring more ART to people at a lesser price. Now, what about the guidelines? Well, we've done a quick rough and dirty survey, and it looks like there are a number of countries that are out there that are using the less than 350 criteria, 29 to be specific. We've got others that are considering it or have variations on the theme, and then there's countries that are in the process of decision-making. And WHO, one of their roles is to go out and support ministries of health to adapt these new guidelines, and I imagine many of you are involved in that process as well. These are implications, I'm going fast, I'm sorry, but you've got a few things up here that we need to think about and consider. When you raise the CD4 eligibility, then ART coverage will decrease. So politically, that's a problem. You go from 40% coverage down to 15% coverage in some countries. So that how the ministries will deal with that is an issue. It looks like we're going backwards instead of forward. Treatment costs, it may increase, but we're looking at the costs on that and particularly the benefits and cost effectiveness, which I think we need to do in the same breath as the inputs and the cost for ART. It has to be a more complex equation than that. The non-drug related costs I spoke about, laboratories, we need wider access to better laboratory monitoring. HIV testing we spoke about, human resources, and we're thinking on looking at this, and you will need far more people to help roll out ART, but we think that you'll get some benefits that may save you some costs there or some resources there. And then there's a worry about waiting lists and prioritization, and our focus is on getting the sickest people on treatment as early as possible. So the next steps, we'll be working with ministries and we'll be working with our partners and stakeholders to adapt these guidelines. We need to move progressively towards adapting the recommendations and actually address the operational questions. These guidelines are only the first step, obviously. We need to prioritize resources and then not compromise the ART access or exclude those most in need. And that's the end of the talk, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thanks, Ruben, for an excellent, very fast talk. It will give more possibility for questions, but I would like to take the questions together after Olaide speaks. So the next speaker is Olaide Akani, and she is a journalist. She is with Journalists Against AIDS, based in Nigeria, but she is also a member of the Pan-African Treatment Action Movement and of the African Civil Society Coalition on HIV/AIDS. So she will be setting the scene on what is the situation that we are facing at present, some of the opportunities, some of the threats. Olaide, please go ahead.
Thanks. Good evening, everyone, and thanks to MSF for inviting me to this panel. I think that in setting the stage on threats and opportunities, the video that we just watched and the perspectives of the people who were interviewed kind of highlight some of the threats and the opportunities that I will be speaking to. So where are we now? The last speaker has alluded to some of the points, but I just also wanted to highlight some other points. The fact that there's a reduction in AIDS financing, and that has been reemphasized over and over again in this conference. The fact that there's also a lack of sustainable, long-term, predictable financing for scaling up. The G8 is failing on its commitments. The national governments are backtracking. You know, there's a global recession. And there is still some misconception or uncertainty about the definition of what universal access really is at country level, and that is going to definitely inform how they scale up. And then there is a clear failure of most countries to meet the universal access targets. Many countries lack ambitious targets anyway, so that in itself is a challenge, and there's limited access to treatment and services for key populations. Now, what are the current threats? Some of the current threats I've highlighted earlier. There's a funding gap. There's a shortage and overstretching of healthcare providers. There are potential consequences of AIDS treatment delays and denial. There's fatigue on the part of governments and civil society. There is centralization of prevention, treatment, and care services, so people in the rural areas are not able to sufficiently access care. Then there are the drug pricing-related issues that has been alluded to. When we scale up, definitely cost becomes an issue.
And one of the speakers in the video had also alluded to the issues of his concerns about drug pricing and the fact that right now the generic industry is being undermined. And then, of course, there's the big issue of criminalization and human rights violations of key populations. What are the opportunities? We now have strong evidence that treatment as prevention works, both for people living with HIV and those who even have TB and are co-infected with HIV. There are guidelines and there's evidence, which has been expected from WHO, on the cost-effectiveness of early initiation of treatment. Even though we have a global recession and people are talking about flatlining of resources, the fact that there's financial pressure also presents an opportunity for us to think innovatively about funding the scale-up process. And a lot of discussions have been going on in this conference about the opportunities that exist, which we can explore. You know, there's a lot of talk about the currency transaction levy and financial transaction tax, which are new innovative mechanisms, which should be in addition to the ODA that developed countries have promised. And then, of course, there's the Global Fund, national governments. And I just want to speak briefly on national governments and on the fact that even though we've missed 2010 as a target, and we know that governments are not funding the process as they need to, I think this failure of us to miss the target presents an opportunity for the ministers of health and the finance ministers to begin to talk strategically about how do we ensure that countries allocate efficient resources. And in talking about that, financial ministers allocating efficient resources, I think it also is, it presents an opportunity for countries to negotiate with the IMF and all of these other bodies to say, look, we need to prioritize health. If we're going to achieve universal access, whatever limitations or restrictions that you are putting on us need to be released. You know, we need to be free from these restrictions so that we can be able to deliver universal access for our people. And then there's the opportunity of treatment simplification. A lot of people who spoke in the video talked about the fact that they want treatment to be simplified. And if treatment is simplified, it presents a great opportunity to scale up to as many people who need it. These I just also want to scale through briefly. And the fact that we're having the MDG summit in September present an opportunity to discuss again with governments about the need to focus on universal access, even in the context of attainment of the MDGs by 2015. There's also a whole lot of accountability mechanisms and consultations that countries are planning, that UNAIDS is supposed to spearhead in countries to ensure that the discussions on achieving universal access go on. And I think these consultations present an opportunity for governments to come together, provide a strong evidence base to show how they're going to scale up and ensure that treatment reaches those who need them. Thank you very much. And I'm open to questions after.
Thank you both. Well, we're doing incredibly good in timing. Everybody speaks very fast, so we'll have a lot of time for questions. So let me open the floor for questions. And please indicate maybe who you are and who you're directing the question to, please.
Hi, my name is Mandisa Mbali. I'm an academic at Yale University in the United States. I want to direct my question to Olayide. I hope I pronounced that correctly. I think one challenge facing us is that within a country's government, not all ministries are equal. So you can find that a government's priorities are set more by the finance ministry or by the trade ministry than by the health ministry, and that the trade ministry doesn't listen to the health ministry. So I would like to hear ideas about how we could maybe empower, for instance, African health ministers to work more closely with their trade ministries to really kind of sort of be proactive around generics, for instance, or with their sort of finance or foreign affairs ministries to ensure adequate development aid.
Yeah, thank you for that question. I think it's an important one to consider in the light of the fact that recently the finance ministers backtracked on, the African finance ministers backtracked on the commitment made by the African presidents in 2001. The African governments committed to allocating 15% to health, and the finance ministers backtracked and said, no, we can't do that. That's not our reality. We're not able to commit that. And I think that that dialogue needs to begin to happen at the country level, And it's important that partners in country help to facilitate those processes, as well as, you know, ensure that there's interministerial discussions. Because on the one hand, the finance ministers are looking at things from a financial perspective. They probably are not prioritizing health. On the other hand, the health ministers are looking at it from a totally different perspective. And I think, you know, it boils back to the whole discussion about the fact that, you know, health is a key development indicator. And if we're going to achieve progress, if we're going to increase GDP at country level, the health and the welfare of the citizens of that country and their access to treatment and care services is essential. And I think, you know, these are discussions that even we as civil society can begin to ensure that, you know, the dialogue happens in country. Thank you.
So, microphone two.
We are on microphone two. Alaide, another question for you, as you come from Nigeria. As it was alluded by Carl in his introductory speech, I personally strongly believe in quantitative targets. And I think when WHO invented the 3x5, it was a very good way to hold everybody accountable. We have in South Africa something called NSP, National Strategic Plan, and with very precise quantitative target on a certain number of achievement, and there is a paritary commission, civil society, government to follow on a regular basis on where we are on that plan. It didn't work always very well, but nowadays I think it works extremely well, and it allows to see how much we are progressing. My question is, do you have such thing as a national quantitative strategic plan in Nigeria, country known to be with not a very high coverage and a very high dependency on external donor? And do you have something like SANEC, where you meet regularly with government and you can see how much they achieve on their commitment?
Thank you very much for that question. I think that one of the things that pushed, or one of the processes that pushed the quantitative target happened in 2006, when the then President Obasanjo had demanded that he wanted to see that 250,000 people were placed on treatment by June 2006. Of course, that didn't happen by June 2006, but it provided the impetus for the National Agency for the Coordination of AIDS, which is the NACA, to actually work together with partners to do that. But one of the things that that target helped to do was to help ensure that partners were working together as far as achieving treatment targets were. Because before Obasanjo's announcement that he wanted a target for 250,000 people by 2006, people were working, everybody was working in silos, you know, but because of that, there was a treatment working group that was established and all of the partners supporting treatment came together. Recently, the government has launched a new strategic plan for 2015 because the last one expired in 2009, and there are clear targets for achievement of treatment access. Right now, the government reports that they have 350,000 people on treatment, more than 350,000 people on treatment. And there are actually fora that the National AIDS Council organizes every month to provide feedback, get partners together to say, what are we doing, you know, who is doing what. But definitely one of the challenges that has been identified is there is still very limited local ownership. We had a national conference in May, and at that national conference, it was clear that only about 10% of funding is actually coming from the government. 90% of funding is still coming from external donors. And so it's back to us as civil society and as civil society and activists to pressure our parliamentarians to, you know, to commit more resources to health. Because you're right, you know, we have the burden and we need to take a larger chunk of the response. And it's also about government priority and, you know, prioritization of that issue.
Dr. Wafa in the back.
Yes, hi, Wafa El Sadr from ICAP Colombia. Thank you very much for the presentations. I guess I think nobody in this room will disagree with the idea of the importance of obviously increasing the breadth of access for our patients, but I also want us to argue at the same time while we're really working towards breadth to also work towards the depth, and particularly the issues around the quality and follow-up of patients. And I think what has been seen in a lot of different programs is that with increasing numbers, what ends up happening is, of course, there's dilution of the ability to follow patients and retain them and make sure they are, you know, all the all the key elements that will actually enable us to achieve the individual benefits as well as the potential community benefits in terms of prevention. So where am I? I guess my sense is, let's not forget the depth while we're seeking the breadth. And I feel like at this meeting, there were, in many of the in the sessions, there were very interesting kernels of ideas and innovations about, and MSF had some of them, about how can we expand this breadth while achieving greater depth. And it'd be interesting if MSF or whoever it is can collate some of these ideas into really a new model of the care that we need to provide in the context of this major effort to embracing breadth. Thank you.
Okay, well, I think this is a question for Carl, maybe, even if you didn't say so. Maybe you can go ahead, and then we'll group some of the questions, maybe, and then we'll go on.
Thanks, Wafa. That was actually a great question, because that is the tension now, because we're delivering some, and I'm going to say some, because if you take some services, if you take something like the three I's, which we branded at WHO, and isoniazid preventative therapy and infection control and intensified case finding, we're doing terribly on that in the facilities that we have. But so I would say that the tension is between how can we expand our services that we're giving now to actually provide access to many more people, while at the same time maintaining quality. And I think there are some programs that are working on that. And the question is how far and how fast can we go to bring services closer to people? I know from seeing programs that a lot of the programs are still situated in places where patients have to travel long distances and these sorts of things. And so I think that is a tension, and I think that's something that we'll need to work on. The WHO and others need to try and figure out and crack. With the caveat being that, everybody, 33 million people will need treatment. And so the breadth is going to have to be pretty broad, and we're going to have to get far more efficient in how we deliver the services.
Okay, let's take the question of Matthew, and then number three, microphone number three. Sorry, it's difficult to see.
Hi, I'm Matt Kavanaugh from HealthGap. So I guess question to Ruben, in terms of, the potential for bending epidemiological curves up there. I live in Washington, and one of the things we're clearly seeing is the debate in which the science that's been revealed at this conference and the economics that are being talked about at this conference, and that I think MSF has been key in highlighting the difference not only in providing higher quality treatment, but providing it faster and to more people more quickly, and the positive benefits you get out of that is not being talked about. And instead, what we're hearing about far and away is a treatment mortgage, as if this is, buying a house, right? But I have in my bag the Zambia partnership framework from PEPFAR, which says that they are committing to make sure that 2009 levels are maintained. That's the commitment currently put in the partnership framework for Zambia. So I guess what would be helpful to me and is to kind of hear from you a little bit about what are the messages that WHO is putting out around the potential for that game-changing progress, so that legislators in the U.S., legislators in the capital of donor countries can shift from a never-ending increasing cost paradigm to a we can change the cost curves and the epidemiological curves paradigm. Thanks.
Thanks, great. I'll do my best to try and answer that. I mean, I think that the work is still in progress. We're still looking at this, but the game changer, at least from my perspective, is that the fact that ART actually adds a prevention benefit. And then the next step in terms of modeling these sorts of things, it's already ongoing, is to figure out how much is that benefit, how do you quantify that, and then to put those into your projections for ART, your projections for prevalence. Once that happens, then policymakers can, and also the other part of that game changer is to look at the economics. And traditionally, I call it doomsday economics, where you just look at the inputs. If you increase eligibility, then the costs are going to go up, and it's a disaster. And nobody really wants to. And it goes up into the near future because there's no prevention benefit. So the two together, the prevention benefit, and then also looking at the downstream benefits, the DALYs and these sorts of things that you get from providing treatment, those things actually will change our calculus, and you will be able to see, well, if you go up to less than 350 and you get very good coverage, 80-90% of the community or whatever the level is, that you will see, not only you'll see a prevention benefit, and we're talking about combination prevention, you'll see a prevention benefit, and over time you will see, that benefit will have an economic impact, and you'll realize the economic benefits. So that's how we're starting to think of it. Of course, you know, these things are evolving, and the, you know, some of the best people working on this are thinking about that. And I think you're going to see a new economics and a new approach to target setting and these sorts of things.
So, but Ruben, I would like to press you a bit more, okay, on that, because if you want to have a high coverage, so what will be then the target by when to have the benefits of this one? Can you say something about that vision also?
Well, what I can say is that we need to come together and look at the and basically do the math and then look at the benefits, and now we've, you know, our guidelines are basically at less than 350, and we know, and but what we need to do now, which, and I think it's a bit complex, but what we need to do now is say, well, what is the prevention benefit for that less than 350 and at different coverage levels, and then what will be the economic, decide on what the assumptions will be, et cetera, what would be the economic benefit from that move to that level, 350, and we can model higher, less than 500, and these sorts of things, project those sorts of things, and then it's a question of sitting down with ministry. I'm sorry to say, but probably ministries of finance, and say, look, you know, if you stay at 200, this is what your prevalence will look like over time, and we'll put the combination prevention in there. This is what it'll look like over time. This is how much your cost will be over the next 40 years or 5 years or whatever the perspective is. Or if you go to less than 350, then you'll get this benefit and this is what it'll look like. Or, you know, if you go higher. I just think clinically and the guidelines are not ready probably to go higher than less than 350, but probably in the future that's where we'll be heading.
Okay, number three then.
Yeah, two suggestions. One is, Ruben, I would like to ask you to go back to Geneva with a mandate from the community to rebrand the three eyes as the four eyes and have it be at immediate heart. Because I think one of the reasons why the three eyes haven't worked is because a lot of people just thought it was just better to keep on scaling up ART and that would be the best way to reduce TB incidence. And so now that the new guidelines are there, I think it gives us the opportunity to rebrand and it makes more sense, actually. So.
Well, okay. I'd like to see you and raise you. I think Four Eyes has some unfortunate connotations, yeah, for you know, there's a eyeglass store in the United States, etc. But so I'd like to go with I'd like to go with the Five Eyes. I think we should be pushing towards integration as well.
Okay.
So
groovy.
So we'll go for five. But
right,
that being said, not to be flipped, to get the Three Eyes branding through WHO was probably took about 10 years off my life. So but that's fine. We'll give it a shot, Mark.
And then the second ambitious suggestion I want to make is that we reframe the debate around the Global Health Initiative, that those of us that work in the United States should reframe the debate about the Global Health Initiative to double the budget from a game-ending initiative that wouldn't meet any of the MDGs, which is what the current proposal is with $63 billion over 6 years. Let's move it to $125 billion over 5 years and put in the health systems and the health worker training and the task shifting and the R&D agenda that's also needed to achieve the MDGs. I think that if the activists start demanding this from the U.S. government and then we figure out what the rest of the global community should pitch in, we would greatly increase our chances of achieving the MDGs and sort of getting our way around this impasse that we've been in ever since Zeke Emanuel moved into the White House.
Okay, microphone number two.
Yes, Els Torele, Access to Medicines Initiative at the Open Society Institute. I have a question to WHO. I was actually quite surprised, if not shocked, to read on one of your slides that you put it as a statement that the cost of the treatment will go up, and I think that is based on the observation that today the better first-line treatments and second- and third-line treatments are indeed more expensive than what is currently available as the lowest price as the first-line. Now, I would like to challenge that in the sense that to my knowledge, there is no technical or scientific reason why these drugs have to be more expensive. And the only reason why they're more expensive is because there are patent monopolies. Now, we have shown in the past that this can be changed. We have created generic competition through various mechanisms. And I think that if there is political will, we have these mechanisms available. There is voluntary licensing, compulsory licensing, patent pools, and all kinds of stuff that we can use to bring the prices down. And it would be really helpful if WHO and actually others in this conference have said the same thing, and that others would challenge that and would make recommendations to reduce the prices as part of what we need to do in the future to expand and to get to universal access to treatment.
It's a great question. Let me back off from what I said during that slide a little bit. And I guess the point that I was trying to make is that, yeah, we should not stop on trying to lower pricing for drugs. But what I'm trying to say is that the vast majority of the price or the cost of actually delivering ART and other services, it's not the drug prices. It's everything that's wrapped up around the drugs. And so we need to work on reducing that cost. And the more we can do that, the larger the gains will be. But that's by no means to say that we shouldn't be working on lowering prices and making sure that drug prices should come down. And I would argue, I mean, I'm not an expert in this area, but I would say that the more people we put on treatment, the economies of scale would argue that your drug pricing would come down. It would have to be that way, or it should be that way if markets work, right?
Nathan?
Nathan, MSF. I'd like to call on Carl, if I may. My question is that this conference, we've been very much, you know, fighting to support the WHO recommendations of 350 in the face of donors who are unwilling to support that for lack of funds. You mentioned, Ruben, that we, you know, there's not enough evidence yet for 500, but we could imagine being back here in 4 years' time having exactly the same debate with the donors but around a different threshold. And so my question for Carl was to ask what his sense of that debate and those trade-offs are, and if he can imagine a way out of this this paradigm of rationing access to essential medicines by degrees of sickness.
Are you okay? It's not working.
Thank you for that question. I think it's actually an absolutely critical question that we need to embrace. I actually, as I think about it, I'm a believer in access for all, and currently the U.S. guidelines say treat to 500, so I think it's actually a course that we're going to come across very soon, is that whether or not the START trial in the United States ends up proving feasible and actually gets run, evidence will continue to accumulate that the earlier you treat, the better. And the same arguments that you make for the economic benefit of starting at 350 will apply to 500. And the point is that HIV treatment reduces healthcare costs in the long term. If it's a benefit to tuberculosis to the level of 75% to 90%, to treat at 350, it'll even be greater at 500. So we can turn the tables on the economists and say, and instead of talking about the cost, talk about the long-term savings. Because ultimately, the combination of benefit to the individual of early treatment, improved economic output within communities, reduction of tuberculosis, reduction of further expansion of the HIV epidemic, linked to innovation of other, whether it's a therapeutic vaccine or cure, this will become the game changer. We need to change the conversation. Somebody said, no more discussion about treatment mortgage. Talk about the economic benefit. Because I think that's where researchers, where the World Bank, where we need to work together to prove that there is an economic benefit to early treatment. I think that's going to be the major game changer. So thank you.
I don't know if you had a chance to see Jim Kahn's presentation. He's part of our informal costing group, but he had a nice presentation. I can't remember which. I think it was on Tuesday or Monday. And we're looking at this for South Africa, working with some folks down there as well. And the economic benefits are huge. We were talking about the hundreds of millions of dollars over the over a 5-year horizon. And this is for the health sector alone. And then you're starting to talk about break-even points. Now, of course, these are all dependent on assumptions and these sorts of things. But and that economic analysis didn't even include the macro, looking at the society, how much does a child who lives a full life, how much do they contribute? So I think that's going to be really exciting. I think it's going to be quite easy to convince people that that the economic benefits are on the plus side of expanding treatment.
Yeah, I also agree that, you know, these are the kind of discussions that the health ministers and the finance ministers should be having, even at country levels, talking about what are the benefits going to be to the country and to the individual when, you know, we have to scale up treatment. Thank you.
Okay, great. So I think we set already some of the questions also. We need certain game changers. That's what we're going to discuss in the next panel. So thanks a lot to our speakers, and thanks for the very interesting questions. I should have said that Sharon Ann is going to come and moderate the next panel.
Eric, I think we're going to start pretty quickly with you. Hi, thanks for coming and joining us tonight. My name is Sharon Ann Lynch, and I'm with MSF. I'm a HIV policy advisor with the Access to Essential Medicines campaign. Is this okay? You can hear me. You know, a comment, we held a press conference earlier, and part of it was to talk about the issue that Els brought up in terms of drug pricing, and also the fact that throughout this conference we're hearing an awful lot about cost-effectiveness, as Carl mentioned, and efficiencies. But somewhere in that, certainly the patients are lost, and I don't see much humanity in there as well. And so we would like to take the opportunity for Dr. Eric Gomar, who has been working in South Africa, and some of the other panelists to discuss some of the patient-centered efficiencies. And when we talk about the cost curves, please know that in addition to the benefits that Carl spoke about the community level, we also mean to bend the cost in terms of reducing the burden on patients, on people who are on ARVs, reducing the requirements of the health system, and reducing the cost of per patient per year. So let's start with Dr. Eric Gomar. He's the regional medical HIV and TB advisor for MSF in South Africa. While he's looking for his presentation. No, he's good. Then Tito will be talking later and be talking about some of the enabling policy frameworks that is needed to usher in some of the innovations. Also on our panel is Janice Lee. Janice is a pharmacist with the Access to Essential Medicines campaign, and we'll be talking about some of the future prospects of promising molecules that are in the pipeline, as well as strategies to reduce the cost of current ARVs while, of course, maintaining quality. Eric?
Thank you, Sharon Ann. Good evening, everyone. I will not thank MSF because I'm part of it, but I will thank you all to come so late at the end of this tiring week to attend this satellite session. I'll do my best to bring some provocating thoughts here about what Sharon Ann just said. So we heard Robin speaking about bending the epidemic curves, and I thought, well, At a local level, there are other curves also that altogether we'd better to bend. It's the clinical workload curve to be more efficient, and I will define that later on. And this idea to distribute tasks between whoever is available among the health staff and among them the community staff, increasing the patient autonomy and adherence, especially in the long term, and finally, reducing the pill burden and the pill toxicity, as it was alluded by different people during the interviews. So here I have a little drawing in a nice virtuous circle that says basically what a lot of people have tried to explain here, is that by increasing the coverage and lowering the CD4 threshold, inevitably you reduce the clinical time per patient needed for per patient. You are allowed to decentralize to primary health care and get more and more community health worker support and go towards a patient self-management. Of course, this is pending, and I'll speak to that quite a bit today, tonight, pending. One of the conditions is to have a patient-friendly regimen. It's obvious that we can only talk about this because we have now in perspective completely different regimen than the kind of regimen that we had initially, and typically with the kind of second-line regimen that we are using still today, I don't think this would be feasible. So I thought that the best way to illustrate this was this poor dog who had to go through these three circles in fire, and the three circles in fire represent the burden for the health service, the burden for the patient first, and the drug toxicity, while trying to go to this beautiful surfer. It's not because I live in Cape Town, but I don't surf, but you know, this perspective that you can at some point literally surf the wave and be in front of the wave instead of being systematically on the back of the wave. This is only possible, of course, if you change locally, and I speak again locally here, of the, you change locally the picture that you have with the patient attending the clinic. You see here on the left the evolution of the baseline median CD4 count in Kailicha. And, you know, when we started in 2001 with a median CD4 count around 40, most of the patients were brought on stretchers and were extremely sick. Means for all of you who have this clinical experience, a lot of time to stabilize patient and to be able even to start them on ARVs with a lot of higher risk to be expected afterwards and side effect. The graphic at the bottom shows all this in a clinical stage terms. As you can see here, in 2001-2002, we had 55% of stage 4, while in 2007, and I couldn't find more recent data, you can see the stage 2 picking up and the stage 4 going down dramatically. This only can be achieved, and it's another way to express what a lot of us have tried to express this week. Can we only achieve this sort of transition? Is it has to happen as soon as possible and require an early aggressive approach in what WAFA you called, as far as I remember in the last conference I was listening to you, this emergency phase before we can transit to a chronic phase. So to go further into the detail about distributing tasks, which is called, in other words, task shifting or task sharing, if as some people prefer, actually you can, the first thing to do, it took us, apparently there's still a confusion existing on the entity, a consultation. What is a consultation made of? There is a certain amount of clinical screening, psychosocial support, and drug refill. Actually, with time, you see there is a color code there to say that the clinical screening is going down dramatically, while the psychosocial support is relatively going up with the long-term adherence issues that are requiring ongoing adherence, while drug refill is more or less the same. But confusion, and that's where you see DHL, not that I want to do some publicity for them, but some friends told me that if in England, if you are under the NHS on antiretroviral, actually the clinical consultation have nothing to do with the pill refill, because simply DHL comes to bring you on a monthly basis the your ARVs at home. We cannot afford DHL in most of the sites where we are, so I will explain later on what we do to try to create an alternative to DHL. In terms of task shifting, the fact that a nurse can do the job, and actually very rapidly, has been, I think, established, and it's beyond critics, because there's a lot of evidence there. It started with a retrospective observational study done by my colleague there in Lesotho, showing that in terms of outcome, they were actually equivalent in terms of mortality, but better in terms of retainment in care once you decentralize in a nurse-based clinic. This has been also proven in Uganda and most recently by this famous RCT CIPRA trial that shows beyond doubt that there is non-inferiority when nurses are doing so. Again, I would put a word of caution there. If you have managed to provoke this epidemic, what I call this epidemic transition, and in other words, when patients are not coming all in stage four. So now I looked a little bit, rather Gilles present looked at what would the situation look like in a place like Kelicha, where I've been working for the last 10 years, and a simple model. I reassure you, Ruben, no competition here. It's very simple model for the situation in Kalisha 2009. We had, as you can see, more or less 70,000 patients, among them 58,000 non-ARV and 12,000 on ARTs. New, that's your famous TAP, new infection estimated more or less at 4,000 new infection per year, while we managed in 2009 is a little bit more. Now managed to put to start at 4,000 on ARVs during that same year. Well, the problem is that so we tried to look at 2019, 10 years time, what would it look like from an epidemic perspective? And actually, well, we believe that the incidence is slightly reduced, so maybe, and this is a very conservative, of course, figure, 3,000 new infection per year. Well, actually, we would still have the same reservoir, probably, of people waiting for treatment, but, and I want you to focus on that, the biggest problem is that we would have at least 52,000 people on ARVs in 10 years' time. And I'll just make this point to express the fact that there's no way in the clinics, physically, there's no space to accommodate 52,000. So the day we discovered this, thanks to my colleague there in Kalicha, we started to think about other system. And the system we came with is this so-called adherence club. It's a community, it's supposed to be, it's not yet, it's supposed to be decentralized in the community. Instead, the principle of a club is that instead of doctor or nurse appointment, it's 20 to 30 patients are allocated to one club. They are managed by a counselor or expert patient, so called. And there is a principle of peer supported, this global support. Instead of individual consultation, everything happens in group. For the patient, it means a huge difference, because instead of waiting for one full day in the clinic to be seen by potentially a nurse for 10 minutes, while, of course, it's only for stable patient, while they can do it for only 2 hours. And instead of having monthly refill, they have only they will receive 2 to 3 months refill. So this, we don't have, unfortunately, the outcome yet. We are busy collecting the outcome of this. But needless to say, in qualitative focus group interview, both with the nurses and with the patient, it was a very popular initiative. Looking at Tiolo in Malawi, there is another idea that came out. They are decentralizing to the health center over there, but they thought maybe this is not good enough, so they started an outreach initiative where one nurse and accompanied by 2 to 3 community workers are going to those advanced health posts to basically deliver a minimum package of HIV services, check on adherence, and of course, main function, assure that patients are resupplied with ARVs. And third but not certainly not least, an experience that was done in TET, Mozambique, Northern Mozambique, and presented here in this conference in a poster, where actually it goes one step further at a community level. This is purely driven by expert patient. It's a sort of support group with heart provision. They elect a representative to go to collect ARVs at the nearest health center, and this one brings back the pills for the group of a maximum of 6 patients. In terms of outcome, it's a relatively fresh initiative, started in June 8, so it has only 18 months, and unfortunately we don't have the outcome at precise time point. There's a mix there of patients who have been started early and started later, but you see among these 1,253 patients, excellent result in terms of remaining in care and with extremely low loss to follow-up rate. Let me now address briefly a totally different subject about bending the curves, and it's the third one. It's the issue of drug toxicity and cost. In MSF, there is a large group working together with the Clinton group on dose optimization, and with a triple objective. Of course, it's to reduce patient toxicity in the future, reduce pill burden, but also reduce the cost. Everybody knows in this room about what was done about D40, reducing from 40 to 30 milligram. But actually, there are many other drugs there that could potentially, and this was a discovery for me, be reduced in their dosage. And it was explained to me that it's due to the fact that dosage is usually fixed in phase 2 trial and not reviewed afterwards for different reasons, so that usually drugs are overdosed. I think Andrew Hill from the Liverpool University is central in his research, has been working on this for the last 10 years. Just to illustrate what it did for D4T, and this is figures that are coming from the referral ID unit that we have in Cape Town, where we are sending all our patients, thanks to Charlotte Schulz there. You see this curve here where we had up to 4% of severe hyperlactatemia due to D40 in 2005, while it was decided to reduce D40 to 30 milligram, and immediately you see that the number of patients in exactly the same condition started to diminish. Thanks to a drug reduction, but also this little machine called Accutrend that allowed every service provider to measure lactate as a point of care. Of course, the question remains, and that's why I've barred the 20 milligram. There is some disagreement still whether D40 20 milligram is an option, but I will not enter into that one. Apparently, they are, as I mentioned, well, Zidovudine AZT is actually still commercialized at 250 milligram here in Europe, and nobody knows exactly why the dosage has been increased to 300, but some they are tests doing to reduce the dosage to 200 milligram BD, cut 3TC by half, cut efavirenz, and this, I think, in terms of toxicity, might have a large impact, cut efavirenz from 600 milligram to 400 milligram, and the same for lopinavir. Most of those, they are ANCHOR trials, results I expected probably by beginning 2011. And these studies are funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the University of South Wales. Let me now just finish on those two slides, looking at the long-term and long-term therapeutic strategy. And there comes a question in terms of treatment paradigm Should we have a different treatment paradigm for high prevalence, low resource country compared to the one existing in a high resource country? And of course, this is still, we spoke about it with Carl earlier in the week, and this is still open for a lot of discussion, but we are for the moment in a paradigm of sequential regimen, one following the other, requiring a lot of monitoring there. And the question is, should we not go for a new paradigm based on induction and maintenance? So it would look something like that, with a very aggressive induction regimen, of course robust and aggressive in, to reduce the viral load initially, and then a long-term poorly toxic regimen and a switch not requiring much monitoring. Of course, it would require some drugs with very potent for induction, but for the maintenance phase, probably a PI-based regimen with safe and minimal side effect, and as much as possible, an RTI-sparing to avoid the long-term antimicrobial effect. There are some promising new drugs out there. Well, it's difficult to beat nowadays these 3-in-1 tenofovir 3TC efavirenz that seems to be coming in. I've put this little blister next door because I think it's a unique opportunity. As we have one pill once a day, why not to put it in a blister with dates to remind patients about taking their pills? New promising drugs, rilpivirine, apparently a very long alpha. It's in phase 3, and Tibotec is, I heard, is studying it for injectable formulation, maybe for PrEP. Elvisitabine, an RTI in phase 2. This prodrug of TDF, that seems to be much more potent than TDF, and could be administered once a week. And to finish, but this we switch to what Tito has to say, point of care test, I will not elaborate too much here to remind everyone how much it was a revolution 7-8 years ago to move from this ELISA, where you had to send a blood sample to a lab and wait for the result, and with sometimes a very long turnaround time to this rapid test. And of course, what we are all looking for is to simplify this fantastic machine into viral load dipstick, for which a prototype are already circulating. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Eric. Now we're going to hear from Janice Lee. Janice is going to be going through some of the drugs that are currently in the pipeline, and again, strategies on optimizing the drugs we already have.
So I'm asked to speak about the antiretroviral drug pricing. So I'm going to show you the prices that has been in the past, what we're seeing at present, and the future pricing. So what did we learn from all these antiretroviral, since we started to have access to antiretroviral? This graph shows a basic starbutine, lamotrigine, nevirapine, which is the most widely used combination in the developing world, which has helped access to heart. In the beginning before the treatment started in developing countries, the drug cost as high as $10,000 per patient per year. And look what happened today. This year, the drug is dropping to $67 per patient per year. And there is a 99% decrease in the originator, not fixed dose combination, but individual drugs. And there's a 76% decrease in the generic 3-in-1 fixed dose 30 milligram saludine combination. And what about the prices of improved first line? So we stop talking about stability now. What we're interested in now is the future, what we're going to use will be mainly zidovudine-based or tenofovir-based. So if you use NNRTI, which is nevirapine, the cost is much lower, but it's very similar between zidovudine and tenofovir because these two single molecules, they cost about the same. If you move to use efavirenz NNRTI, which is more patient-friendly in terms of TB drug interaction, the cost of a regimen, tenofovir-containing regimen, is 176 per patient per year. But sad to say that these drug prices are only available for countries where there are no IP access barriers. So price for middle-income country, for example, from the originator drug, still cost at 1,033, and this is only limited to a list of middle-income countries. What about the prices as we go from first line to second line to third line regimen? Here we see the lowest first line regimen with AZT treated nevirapine is 137 per patient per year, and as we move to second line, the cost triple to 465 per patient per year with atazanavir, ritonavir, which now is recommended by WHO as one of the PIs to be used in second line. And then as we move from second line to a possible third line therapy, which this last year in 2009, it's already mentioned in WHO guideline as a need, though we do not know what would be the combination. A possible combination could be Rautegravir, Darunavir boosted with Etravirine, and that costs 3,204 per patient per year. And this is seven times a cost of second line and more than 23 times the cost of the cheapest improved first line. And why is it so expensive? It's because they are all originator drugs. There's no competition. And basically, there's no production in India because all these drugs are already patented in India. So you can get all this information in our yearly publication of Untangling the Web. We started the publication in 2001 because there was a lack of pricing, transparent ARVs pricing and reliable information. It's used a lot as lobby advocacy too. Quotes in publication, source of price comparison, there's patent information and access issues. And it is one of the most comprehensive pricing information available on originator ARV drugs. And we have distributed 1,000 copies already in Vienna, so there will be no hard copy available. But don't worry, we are available online. And if you are not very green, you can click a button and print out the whole copy. So in my next presentation, I'm going to show you some of the cost projections of antiretrovirals, projections in 2040, which very grateful has been provided by the Clinton Health Access Initiative. When I was working as a pharmacist, I used to have patients coming to me asking me why the drugs are so expensive. And my naive answer to them is that it's because the companies, they need to recuperate on R&D, and so they need to charge more on the drugs. But as I joined the Access campaign, I realized that there's a lot of other issues involved in the drug pricing. So what you're going to see next would be, I will put a disclaimer because I don't want to be sued by the companies. These prices are estimations of products
which is commoditized in generic market based on costing models, where APIs constitute 70% of the cost of the drug. As we know, there's published paper, Brazilian study showed that 55 to 99% of the direct manufacturing cost of the drug is represented by the active pharmaceutical ingredient of the drug. And this cost estimate of some of the pipeline drugs that you're going to see is based on triple FDC and not indicative of a single product price. They do not address access-related issues other than the long-term cost in a competitive market. And also the pipeline drugs that you're going to see shown here are for the interest of the price comparison, and more data, of course, is needed to determine the safety and efficacy. So I want to show you the first slide of the drug group NRTIs. As you can see here that in 2014, with generic competition, with economies of scales, these are the prices you're going to see per patient per year. And we in the pipeline, there is a drug in phase two, which has cost from $6 to $12 per patient per year. And yes, and this drug is due in phase two. And moving on to NNRTI. So in 2014, you may see the price of nevirapine and efavirenz decrease to whatever it is shown here. And still, perhaps in the pipeline, we should look at Tibotec's rilpivirine, which is still in phase three studies. And there seems to be, a very competitive price here at $7 to $15 per patient per year. And here are I grouped together the protease inhibitors and the integrase inhibitors. I just want to say that the Elvitagrave and GS9350 cobicistat is not yet marketed. They are in phase three studies by Gilead. And the Rautagrave and Darunavave pricing here are pricing estimates using conservative long-term estimates on generic API costs, representing pricing in a commoditized generic market. So what's interesting is that when you look at all these drugs, it seems like Elvitagrave, which needs a boosting, and it's been developed by Gilead with a booster, its own booster, cobicistat, and the drug will cost 120 to 200. But if we use, we boost it with ritonavir, for example, it can cost 90 to 130 per patient per year. And this is one-third the price of rautagrave. And Eric talked about dose optimization, and there are lots of people working on dose optimization, and they are not pharmaceutical companies, not funded by pharmaceutical companies. This, if it really turns out to be to have data showing that these drugs can be dose optimized, let's look at the savings per drug. So if you multiply these savings by the number of people whom we are going to put on treatment in the future, 5 million now, 15 million in 2015. Am I correct, Sharon?
Yes, please.
So it's a lot of savings. And let's look at the price. If we dose optimize our drugs, and we use some of the pipeline drugs that are relatively cheap, what will we arrive to? So we can see on top the current regimen price of first line, second line, and third line. And then we dose optimize our current first line with tenofovir and 3TC 150 and efavirenz 400. it reduced to 121. We use AZT reduced dose, Lamivudine reduced dose, and Efavirenz reduced dose, we come to 116. And if we use AZT reduced dose, Lamivudine reduced dose, and Atazanavir booster reduced dose, it's 300. And all these are cheaper than the current price at the moment. And we could also, some of the newer drugs are also being studied or going to study for dose optimization, and this could really translate into very attractive drug pricing for us to start thinking about what is the best regimen for our patient, not in terms of cost, in terms of which drug is the best to use in which line and which line we want to use them. And then looking further below, using some of the ARVs in pipeline, not to say we are advocating, you know, cheap drugs to be used, because of course more data have to be seen, but bear in mind that this could turn out to be some of the game changers that we're talking about in this satellite. So in an ideal world, we would like to have, you know, the dose of our drugs optimized so that we have less, patients have less side effects. We would like to see generic competition, even if there's one generic who's producing it and there's no competition, it doesn't work. So we need competition. We want to live in a world where there's no intellectual property access barriers. Of course, initiatives such as compulsory license or patent pool, it's, you know, should be used much more. Not to forget that some of these drugs, the process chemistry has resulted in some of the very sharp price decrease that we see over the last 2 years. Just to cite an example, they found a new process synthesis for Efavirenz, and now the price is reduced by 30% in over a year. And that translates to a triple combination of generic TDF-TDC Efavirenz, which is much more affordable. So is there more to cost? Well, I think so, because as we're talking about cost, we also hear from the video when we started the satellite that people are talking about less drug toxicity. People want to see less drug toxicity, and we are. And I think cost-effectiveness study is useful to measure the health benefits gained when you use a better regimen. And I just want to highlight there is an analysis of patients started on tenofovir regimen in Lesotho, which is going to be presented tomorrow at the oral late breaker session from 11 to 12:30, session room 4, which will find out about how much we would like to see the drugs price reduced to in order to have all the health benefits gained. And thank you, and lastly, I would like to acknowledge the people who has contributed to this presentation.
Thank you. We're a little bit pressed for time, so we're just going to go straight to Tito and then take your questions. And then remember, Dr. Peter Mugeni is going to be giving closing remarks, and then partly in a bit of reaction to some of the new information that we're providing on this panel. Thanks. Tito.
Thank you. I will not give a presentation, but I want to start us continuing the conversation about the game changers. And I think one area that we started to talk about is what I would call the radicalization of the ART tools and the deliveries. The second, I would say, is the new ways to manage intellectual property in terms of aggressive use of TRIPS flexibilities and an effective patent pool. And thirdly, financial transaction tax and treat. So on the first one, I think a lot of this has been mentioned here already, and we probably will continue some of the discussion in terms of the importance of the treatment for prevention really as the game changer, and some of the aspects that Eric has explained in terms of the more patient-friendly delivery that we think we can achieve in the next few years with tool optimization and the way we deliver care. But I just wanted to also really re-emphasize the importance of point-of-care diagnostics, and Mark made that point in this video. And I will be believing here with the conference with at least, I think, some better hope on where we are with CD4 now. We have at least two that are now going to be going to field testing that are getting us close into an affordable point of care testing. That's one is the CD4 initiative that has worked with Xiomix. And that's a little unit where the capillary blood is filled. It is spun in a manually driven kind of centrifuge. Then you twist it, and then you spin it once more, and then you can read the result. And it seems the whole thing takes about 6 minutes. Their target price is $2 per test, and the actual kind of centrifuge they're having is probably also very cheap, and it's manual, it has no electricity. The other one that I really found very intriguing here is the Ductory, which is also it's a portable unit, it's battery driven, and it works a little bit like our old tape players when we were small, and it's this cartridge that is next to it where you directly after the fingerprint the blood is delivered into it, and that also takes less than 10 minutes. The target price, I think, is $6 for this cartridge. The unit itself is about probably going to be about $300. So I think they have to go into real field validation, but I think we're getting those point of care CD4 finally more firmly really on the horizon. I think viral load is going to be is obviously is absolutely essential. There are several projects, but it seems there's still much more delay, and I think this really has to become a major priority because it's so essential. Now, the second game changer here is new ways to manage intellectual property, and the reason I'm saying is that drug costs continue to be very important, and our MSF data are a bit different than what Ruben said about 20%. I think we're much more around 50%, depending a bit on the project, and of course we see this cost explosion on the horizon. So I think the real game changers here, and that's been talked about at the conference, one is the medicines patent pool that is now being established, and the critical thing is to make that work, and it's really the onus is on the companies to provide the licenses at the right terms that this patent pool is going to work. But it's an additional tool to what we need to have see as a much more really aggressive and widely use of the flexibilities that exist in the international trade agreement, including strict patentability criteria, patent oppositions like they're practiced in India, use of compulsory license and others. Thirdly, really know some of the threats that are out there in terms of free trade agreements or anti-counterfeit legislations and agreement that are really harming access to medicines. These have to be stopped in order to really secure the generic competition that we know is more efficient in terms of reducing prices than tiered pricing. I think we will see very widely promoted, I think in the coming months, tiered pricing, differential pricing is the same thing, promoted as a widely as the solution. And I think we have to be cautious. And also the kind of dose optimization, the production costs that Janice referred to, you can only realize them if you have generic competition. Now, lastly, and is the big game changer, I think, will be the additional funding for health, tax and treat, a precondition before we get into a financial transaction tax is still that the Global Fund is going to be replenished in later this fall with more than $20 billion. You know, the $20 billion does not include the full implementation of the WHO recommendations. But as a real major opportunity for additional resources, the financial transaction tax that can really raise the additional resources needed, what we could say, to bail out the health-related Millennium Development Goals. And one type of tax within that is the currency transaction tax, which can be started between any two currencies at any time. So this is something that can be really kickstart right away, even if you do not have immediately a global agreement. And it's politically and technically feasible. You know, this is discussed at high political level without necessarily saying this money should go to health. And I think this is something we have to fight for. And there are some key dates now in September with the MDG in New York and then the G20 in Korea, where I think all of us have to really highlight this as much as we can and as Joseph did here so eloquently on this picture. Thank you.
Peter, would you mind speaking first, providing your remarks? I'm sorry, I told you I was going to give you some minutes to collect your thoughts, but some bossy lady over there won't let that happen. So these are just a few of the future prospects and what we've been calling possible game changers that could radically simplify ART and also facilitate scale-up. So my purpose was to try to impress Dr. Peter Mujeni. He's the director of the Joint Clinical Research Center in Uganda, and as many people know, a defender of people living with HIV and a longtime activist and AIDS doctor working in Uganda. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, and thanks very much for staying for this very important meeting. And really, having heard what I consider one of the conference's most important points made here, and seeing some of you people whom I know are personally involved in this, is very, very touching. I really don't know how I can summarize this. It has been a very good session. But perhaps I could just say a few things. I could start perhaps by talking about the long term. If we don't have a purpose and a target which we are aiming to achieve, we are not going to get there. Carl put it quite plainly. We are in this business so as to have a world free of HIV/AIDS. That's what we are, and this is the target, and this is what we should be working towards. There are many models that we have seen, but one of the most discouraging things that I have seen recently are movements that take us back to the 1990s. In 1990s, we are being told by Hueres, the economists, that AIDS treatment was just impossible, that it would cost too much, and the world would not have the resources. 2 days ago, I got a shock of my life. An economist said the world was awash with money in 2003, and that's why PEPFAR became possible, a contradiction in terms. So really, we have to remain very, very focused. There have been talk about treatment strategies, and we have learned a lot since some money became available over the last 10 years. HIV treatment, AIDS treatment has been scaled up. to a level that was not thought possible. It is now being hindered by lack of funds, by not real lack of funds as such, by really commitment failing to continue to tackle this. We have seen the benefit of HATS. I don't want to go through it again. And me, who works on day-to-day with a big population of HIV patients and who used to see the carnage, and I've seen how it has worked out, I know from first-hand experience what has changed. Among the people we treat, we see less HIV. Less TB. We see less malaria. We see less other opportunistic infection. These, if you calculated them and put them in the equation, I don't know what sort of savings we would be coming up with. Now, looking back to Durban Conference and other AIDS conference, the theme was on drugs costs and failure to access treatment on account of the cost. One of the most pleasing things I'm seeing are young people who are joining in the HIV AIDS mission to get rid of it from the world. But most of them are too young to know what was happening in 1990. But what I would like to say to them, please look at the history and do what is written at the back of her T-shirt. Don't turn back. I like to go to people who have said we want to maintain the 2008 numbers. We want to maintain 2008 numbers. Actually, what is happening, if I may tell you a personal story, is that as we scaled up treatment, we got a commitment from donors, especially PEPFAR. A lot of people came forward to be tested, and we have two groups of people whom we have. One group is totally ignored, increasingly ignored. I'm very worried about that group. That is the group that came forward for testing, that we found HIV positive, that we put in a program called CARE. Some of them have been with us for 8 years. They come to us regularly. We counsel them about prevention, and some of them are helping us with the program. What is really very disappointing is that every 6 months, from the education we have given them, they follow their progress. They have passed, they have kept their promise. We have not kept ours. Ours was simple. The message was in on cards and posters. It was clear. We told these people and promised them, when you are in care, we will look after you, give you preventive treatment when it is needed. But when time comes for you needing treatment, it will be provided to you. These people are forgotten. What we are hearing, we are keeping our promise. Be sure that nobody already started on treatment will fail to continue his treatment. This is not good enough. I called this formula a recipe for chaos. This is what is happening. Who are those people who are in care? HIV/AIDS is a disease that affects anyone, and it comes in families. In certain instances, it might be the wife. Let's take, for example, who hit 200 CD4, the old criteria, and she went on treatment. The husband 6 years later, 2 years or so, whatever, reaches 200. And I want you to imagine, this is not something theoretical. This is something that is now happening in my clinic every day. We are telling them we have reached not 350. I saw a list of countries who are having their 350 criteria for starting. It's on paper, ladies and gentlemen. We are treating less than 50%. Imagine now the husband has come and you say, now we cannot give you treatment. We don't have it. After 8, 6, 5, or 4 years of follow-up, and we tell them we don't have it. So finally, I will go to The Economist. Not to the magazine, but The Economist. The Economist, the magazine, described Africa as the hopeless continent at one time. This is not true. The innovations that have come out of Africa over the last 8 years since success became increased are unbelievable. Thank you for outlining some of them. We have seen how Malawi has come up with cost-effective strategies that reduce costs, which in the end lead to increasing the number of people accessing treatment. Mozambique, my own program, we had a strategy in my own program. For every dollar, we did the work of two, and it has so far worked. So these cost-effective strategies will need to continue. But the bottom line, ladies and gentlemen, more funds are needed. Otherwise, we will not cut, we will not go over that curve. I end with The Economists. These people are really great people. They help us to plan. What I would like them to do as part of our progress, we, the scientists, are trying to find ways in which we can treat HIV/AIDS. Would like our economists to move from being doomsday economists, as it was described, to being people who carry out research that define the way we can cost-effectively treat HIV/AIDS. Yesterday, 2 days ago, I asked a question. If we cannot afford universal access, are we going to afford the carnage? So, ladies and gentlemen, I want us to leave on a highly optimistic note. As we walk out of this door, this is a momentous time. This momentous time has brought us new scientific evidence. This new scientific evidence is very exciting to me. We are seeing descriptions of drugs that can be more affordable, but we need to continue to press through intellectual property to have a fairer way of making money by pharmaceutical companies without killing people. I wrote a book and stated it is not true that the world is so dumb that the only way pharmaceutical companies can make money is by doing it over the bodies of the poor. I don't think we are that dumb. The pharmaceutical companies have shown they can lead the way, and we must work with them to know that their future as a company is to invest in humanity and to know that it will pay in the long term for a disease that we hope we could eliminate in a generation and create other opportunities. I think I'll stop there. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to share.
Thank you.
if anyone has any comments or questions, we'll take those. But I would just like to say thank you all to all the panelists. And in addition, we were hoping to start to inform some of the debates that have been occurring, not just in this conference, but as Matthew said, you know, back in capitals, where unfortunately we hear that some governments are deciding upon the pace of the response to AIDS, not just in terms of speed, but also what interventions and who gets the interventions and when. And we know that the science from this building is certainly that speed is linked to survival. So it's not a static environment. There's dynamism in the field, and not certainly just in price, but other strategies to improve quality. Mark?
Yeah, Peter, thanks for that great talk. I wanted to ask you whether Eric Goosby actually followed up with you when we were on stage together talking about the stockout situation in Kampala, and I told you that Peter, that Eric had told me that there were no PEPFAR stockouts, and you said that wasn't true, and then Eric said, oh, let's talk later. So I wanted to ask you, A, are there any PEPFAR stockouts? B, did Eric follow up? And C, what should we do together to prevent stockouts in this disastrous era that we're in right now?
Tony?
Yeah, thank you very much for the great presentations. It's a comment and a question, in fact, to the panel. If I go back to Malawi, I'm ex-Malawi, 2004, when we started scaling up antiretroviral treatment, we decided on a very simple public health approach, and we decided we would not link ourselves to CD4 counts because we couldn't do it. And wow, were we criticized. We were criticized from within the country, and we were criticized from without the country. And basically, we were criticized for providing second-class care. Now, 6 years later, we're at 2010. We've made good progress, but we're still linked to a CD4 count, which has gone from 200 to 350. And two nights ago, I was at a late breaker symposium where the ministries of health of Kenya, Zimbabwe, Malawi were debating how they would react to the new WHO guidelines, particularly for pregnant women. And Kenya and Zimbabwe said, no, we think these are very good guidelines. We're going to buy lots of CD4 machines, albeit perhaps point of care machines, and we're going to make sure we test everybody and see who's eligible or not. Now, of course, the pot of money is limited. If you spend a lot of money on your CD4 machines, it means you've got less money for drugs. Malawi said, national policy, we've been thinking about this, we're going to test people, and if those pregnant women are found to be HIV positive, we are going to treat them with antiretroviral treatment, and we're not going to worry about a CD4 count because our health system is weak, laboratory infrastructure, etc. Now, the response was quite interesting. There were sort of murmurs of, this is all right, sympathetic murmurs of approval. And you heard a little bit that, maybe this is second class care. No CD4 counts, this is second class care. Now, if there's one thing I've learnt in the 4 days of this conference, it's that if you get HIV, it is bad for you from day one. If I find I'm HIV positive today, I want to start ART today. I don't want to wait for 2 years. So I just wonder, isn't it time to de-link ourselves from CD4 counts? That's what I put to you. I mean, it's all right to use it to monitoring, but do we really need a CD4 count to tell us should we start treatment or not?
Yes, it's also on the application of the new guidelines, because I understand also there is this great opportunity now where the WHO teams are going to discuss with the countries how are we going to make this work. And I have just a bit of a fear, because I hear a lot the word adaptation to the context, and we know what it means often in practice. You will adapt, and it never is going to be higher than what the guideline says, just like Tony says, what we would like to do. So I wanted to also take the opportunity with the WHO people being here to see what they foresee exactly in terms of discussing about the application of the guidelines, not only about the guidelines in an isolated way, but also to bring in some of these changing factors. Can we discuss, can we do business differently?
and not only and maybe do more task shifting and so on. So to widen it up so that we can make sure also that this dichotomy between health system and health workers costs and drug costs are being put together in something that makes sense for the people.
Great, thanks.
Yeah, Mark, thank you for that question. It was very interesting. Eric said that there are no stockouts. Actually, what is happening in Uganda is this, that the patients already on treatment, those already on treatment, are continuing to get their drug supplies. But as I said there, this is not good enough. So I raised this issue with Eric, asking, rather explaining that no new patients, and remember these are the majority, are not being put on treatment. His answer was that we can expect that action. He acknowledged that and said we can expect some action to be taken. Well, we'll take him on his word, but it is not just that. I don't expect quick action on that because it is long overdue. I would urge you, the funders, PEPFAR, to know that in the, not actually in the long term, in the near future, if they can continue the program of putting people in need, those in care on treatment. These are PEPFAR patients already supported in care. If we can fulfill the promise we made to them that they would get on treatment, it would be a good start. So I'm still hoping that a conversation on this issue can continue. But as we stand, this is a very critical question. We are having people still being turned away because they are new patients. Old ones are continuing to get treatment.
Eric, can I ask you to respond in terms of utilizing CD4 tests? And then, Gottfried, I was hoping you could, thank you for coming, you could take Mitt's question, but also Tony's, in terms of treatment as prevention and why we didn't hear much in terms of official communication at this conference from WHO on some of the previous reports and articles.
Yes, Tony, on the use of CD4, there's no doubt that you have marked the entire world personally by driving Malawi towards simplification. It was your brand name, and you have hit the headline, and I've had a lot of discussion in different therapeutic commission in South Africa where they're not easily impressed, the South African, by the surrounding countries, but they were very impressed by Malawi, I can tell you. And you have constructed a paradigm of public health within a program that initially was meant for specialists and individual care. So it's a difficult question, and the thinking is evolving. We still believe that, let's put it like that, there was a lot of discussion of what did we learn from this HIV vertical program. And one of the things we learned probably from history is that building in innovation and political will is certainly something that can make things evolve rapidly. And that's why on our side, today I can see we shift more towards viral load than CD4, and some people say, well, maybe CD4 only for baseline, but not for monitoring, and more viral load. But definitely, first, one size will not fit all, and some program will be much more simpler than other. And secondly, and that's why I presented this new treatment paradigm, we need to think in the future about systematic regimen with an intensive and maintenance phase with no monitoring at all. I agree with you. And some countries will take it because it's as simple as that. They have no access to decent lab, and it will be a permanent barrier. and other countries will keep probably a Western paradigm. So on the MSF side, I'm very glad we keep pushing on innovation because, well, we learned some lesson from the TB treatment paradigm and the dots, and I don't want to fall into that trap.
Are you sure? Yes, he's sure. Gottfried, could I ask you to come up, actually, up here? Well, Dr. Gottfried Hernschel is the new director of WHO HIV department. And Gottfried, I wonder if, I know you weren't here for the whole session, but, you know, certainly there have been calls for a couple of things. One is clear target, and Carl specifically called for a scale-up target of 15 million people by 2015. There have been calls for a robust research agenda. Obviously, there needs to be an enabling policy framework that would usher in some of the technical innovations that we're hearing about. I know.
If it goes beyond three, I need a pen.
You want to?
Well, let's start with those three. Yeah. But also a general observation, because I had attended the UNAIDS town hall meeting, which in the U.S., it was much like a big infomercial here at the AIDS conference. I felt like we were all cheering on the very sharp knives of or products that UNAIDS was selling. And yet WHO was not up on that dais, and yet it's been WHO that has been providing a lot of the data and some of the support for showing that ARVs scaled up, including at higher CD4 threshold, can help to bend more of the epidemiological curves. And we've seen, at least in terms of outside of this conference, to bend some more of the cost curves, both that we've been talking about and on the long-term perspective. Can you speak to those four issues?
Okay. First of all, good evening, and sorry that I wasn't with you the whole evening. It was originally my intention, but then I had another engagement that I couldn't get out of. And thanks, Ruben, for chipping in with the presentation. And thanks for putting this panel together and having the session. And thanks, Peter, for this very encouraging words. A couple of things I would like to mention, even maybe in addition to your requests. First of all, the target. We very clearly will need a treatment target. There's no doubt. We need to have something quantifiable, measurable, towards which we will work. When we discussed, and thanks for Taito and Lynn and your colleagues for your visit at WHO to visit with our DG, when we discussed whether we should put a treatment target forward, 15 by 15 now, or whether we should rather put this into context, I think we all agreed that it would be not useful to put an isolated treatment target forward, such as 3 by 5. I think we have moved on to have an initiative driven by one target, but we will need a set of targets. For us, the opportunity to do this and the process to do this is the following. Number one, as I'm sure you're aware of, countries are now starting to, or invited to review their progress towards universal access. Universal access consultation at the country are taking place. Number two, we are now, based on the information that we received from countries, putting forward and putting together all the information from countries, and we will launch the universal access report around the MDG summit. The third process that is very important for us in WHO, and I believe will be also important more broadly, is the development of our new strategy towards 2015. 2010, the universal access year, we had a strategy up until 2010, so now we are working towards a strategy of 2015. And obviously, scale-up will be the central theme, and universal access will be the sustained commitment that we would like to, that we will propose in that strategy. In that context, based on consultations with countries, we would very much want to put forward, obviously, also a treatment target. 15 by 15 seems to be a logical thing to think about in terms of the numbers, but we have put together a target setting group that works in the context of the strategy development that will come up with proposals, and we hope to have a set of targets ready by October. Okay? But again, we don't want to sit in Geneva or Washington, wherever that is, dream up targets that are not based on realities and haven't been done based on a consultative process with countries and other stakeholders, with governments and other stakeholders. So that's the process through which we would like to have a set of targets that will not just be about treatment and prevention. We would also like to measure issues on our effect and linkages on maternal care, how a scaled-up response would have a benefit on child health and child care, on system strengthening, and other aspects. So we really want to look at this in a more comprehensive manner. The second issue is resources. I think a central theme in this conference, an anxiety that we all share. Will there be enough resources? But I think the question is, and that's a bit the way we would like to change the conversation. It's not just about costs, it's about the need for investments. And investing in what is obviously very important. And we are now, and Ruben and the team in treatment is doing some more work on costing to really look also at cost savings to justify the investments better. Because in this conference, it was all about costs. Yes, there are costs, but I think we need to be more strategic also in saying by having upfront investments, by now changing the threshold, eligibility threshold, we are actually making very clever, very strategic investments in keeping people healthier, alive, and reducing the number of transmissions. So we really have to put our arguments collectively together much better. We need to get away from this polarization that I see a little bit. Well, this one is treatment, the other one is treatment for prevention. We are talking about the same thing. We are talking about scaling up access to medicines, and we need to be much more strategic and also quantify better on what this upfront investment is that we need to make and what the gains are in terms of health outcomes, but also in terms of cost benefits. And we need to put the information together, and that's, I would like to convey to you, a very strong commitment of WHO to formulate this better than we have been able up to now even. Even so, we have some cost figures, but I think we still have some gaps. We recognize this, and we need to fill those gaps very quickly to be in a better position. On the issue of, and I'm sorry, but you need to cut me off if I'm getting too long, on the last issue of why is it 350 and why are we not now saying, maybe everybody who gets a diagnosis should immediately start, as this is starting to happen in some parts of the world. Those guidelines that have just come out have, as I think Ruben would have explained, undergone a fairly rigorous process of looking at the current evidence. WHO, in terms of developing new guidelines, has changed a couple of years the process through which new guidelines can be developed and really has a very rigorous evidence review process. Based on that, and based on the findings that we had, 350 seems to be the best thing to say at the moment, based on the evidence, the firm evidence that we have. We will very soon have to look again. There's so much happening. It's such a rapidly evolving field of new knowledge. It's a very dynamic thing. So I anticipate that we need to start now looking on discordant couple issues very, very quickly. It's coming up. There's this study that we're all very happy about that we saw, obviously. And we will need another revision of the guidelines. But for the time being, we would really like to work with countries, to come back to another question, to see, okay, what adaptation can we work would make sense in a given setting, pushing as much as possible for the 350 threshold. Obviously, we want to have the best standard of care implemented in all parts of the world. In an ideal situation, we do not want to get it back and retrieve to double standards in this world. We can't afford this, and we can't allow this to happen. That's very clear. But we will have to be more do better in terms of looking at the best ways of getting there. Service delivery aspects, obviously we need to continue to drive down, make strong arguments for driving down the costs in getting cheaper and better and simpler diagnostics, etc. I think that all needs to happen. And the forum, we hear about treatment 2.0, it's nothing but a forum to look into those things in a partnership context. Certainly, UNAIDS is there. We will play a strong role, rest reassured, in this. We just met also with Gates this afternoon. There's interest there. We met with Julio Montaner, IES. They're very much pushing for this. We talked to Michelle. This is certainly one of the take-home messages to now go back home. We've created the platform 2.0. Now we need to go back and say, what exactly is it? How can we fill some of those blank spots in the conversation, and how can we collectively move forward in it? Thanks.
Thank you. So just a final word, if you don't mind me, I'm going to quote Dr. Magini in a previous panel, because in the hope that the science becomes implemented and becomes policy, because as Dr. Mugeni said, there is not one science for the rich and one science for the poor. There is only one science. So thank you very much. And the discussion will continue at the MSF beach. Okay, so the discussion will continue at the MSF beach, Danube Canal, close to the subway, U1, Schwedenplatz, with food, drinks, and music. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.